really excited to talk to you today, and I'm really excited to introduce you to the audience. You have such an amazing array of stories to tell, but the most important one is the one that we're going to be focusing on today, which has to do with a very timely subject, because we're taking a look now at some of the repercussions of the Facebook theft. Mark Zuckerberg right now is testifying before Congress, as I understand it, although I haven't been following that. But we're going to reel back time a little bit to a time prior to the internet, which is hard for some people to even fathom because it's so much part of our life. And in fact, we're doing this interview via the magic of the internet. Although I do have you on the phone, which is kind of interesting. We've got a mixture of technologies here. Tell me a little bit about your background, first of all, as a gospel musician, and then we'll move into the other side of things, the work that you were doing after that time.
Okay. I graduated from Ohio State in civil engineering in 1973, and I was also a musician. I was in the Ohio State Marching Band for 4 years and decided that, I got married to Nancy, and we decided to go on the road with a gospel music group that traveled all over the world. We actually, the group we were in was in 27 different countries. We traveled for 3 years, and then I became the European director and moved to the UK, where we really focused on ministry to the Iron Curtain, which included Poland, Hungary, Yugoslavia, Romania, and then the Soviet Union. So that's what I did before, right out of college, and did that for almost a decade. And during that time, we had some very unique experiences, especially in Eastern Europe, where we worked with the Roman Catholic Church in Poland and became good friends with Cardinal Karol Wojtyła, who ended up becoming Pope in 1980. Had us at an audience in Rome where we sang our music out through the Vatican PA system. And that was the day before Lech Wałęsa climbed the gate in Gdańsk, Poland, and started Solidarity. We then actually toured, sponsored by Solidarity, in the first year they were free. And then we decided to try to take this work into the Soviet Union. And to cut a long story short, and many miracles, we ended up getting an invitation to record music by the woman who became the official composer for the 1980 Moscow Summer Olympics. And we ended up getting two of those songs on the official Olympic film. And if you'll recall, that's when Jimmy Carter was boycotting the Olympics over Afghanistan. So it was a very tense time, and we worked with many amazing people in the Soviet Union, and a number of those people ended up serving prison terms pretty directly from working with us. So we also had a firsthand view of what tyranny does to a culture and how a few brave souls can make a big difference in what happens in that society. And so then I came back here and decided to become a management consultant. So obviously that's a logical next step. And did that for a number of years. And then as the internet was beginning and PCs were becoming commercial, I had some ideas for developing software. So I did a number of software projects and then landed the contract to rebuild AT&T's email system in the early 90s. And this was, when you mentioned pre-internet, the internet was around, but it was all Department of Defense. And it was, if you recall, the early 90s when the internet started to become commercial. Well, as it turned out, as I was rebuilding AT&T's email system, internet started, AT&T offered AT&T WorldNet, and I was one of the first 10 websites, commercial websites, that they put up, along with Disney and others. And I supported all of their internal operation with this messaging and also all their key clients with electronic messaging just as the internet was hitting, and then saw some real opportunities to use the internet to improve the way collaboration occurs. And that's when I started my current company, Leader Technologies, in 97. And we set out on a task to determine the best way to use the emerging internet to help people better collaborate. I think I'll stop there and see if you have any questions so far.
Oh, gosh, I have so many questions. I'm just trying to lay a nice foundation for those that may not have a real understanding of what was happening in terms of the internet generally and the way that things were working. Because I remember in the 80s, I was involved in the dark world of DOS, as they say. And so, you know, pre-Windows, right. We were having to, not that I was a programmer, but really if you wanted to use a computer in the 80s, you were really having to work with DOS. Of course, I had an Apple IIe in 1983. But still, it was DOS-based. So there was a huge paradigm shift, I guess, if you want to put it that way, between the 80s and the 90s, if you take a look at even how computers themselves worked, the innovations that were taking place, generally speaking, let alone the connectivity issue. But I'm really interested in that part because I was really trying to work at home when I was having my babies and run a business in the downtown area, and I lived outside of town. So I was using a 300 baud modem. I just want to sort of orient people as to what was happening. It was magical, the idea that you could move any kind of a file from one computer to another virtually, if you want to put it that way, over a phone line. I'm sure that you were very familiar with that technology, but I think that it's really interesting to understand in my own mind how things just moved ahead so exponentially. There you were kind of minding your own business, literally, as the founder of Leader Technologies. When did you actually start that business?
Started Leader in 97, but going back to the 80s, I was one of the first owners of an Apple II in England, and we actually used it in our ministry work. So, yeah, I go back to the same time frame when these computers were fascinating. They weren't too connected. And so, yeah, we've both seen it from the beginnings of networked computers.
Mm-hmm. I remember this idea of, it was called Big Blue and Cousins, and you could actually talk to each other in this very rudimentary way, I guess, in a chat room. What was the difficulty? What was the obstacle to networking and getting people working in real time when you began your work?
When I started doing software development, the real challenge is interface design was one area. There's kind of three layers to building a piece of software. You've got the interface layer, and that's what the user sees. And then you've got the middle layer, which is like the engine. That's what takes the data you put on the screen and manipulates it. And then thirdly is the network layer, where you can communicate it to other people, and they can communicate with you. So in the early days, the third layer, the network layer, was pretty non-existent. And so as the internet started developing and we started becoming aware of what it could do, another thing happened at the interface layer, and that was the browser. The internet browser became this universal front end that people could write programs to without having to kind of build it from scratch. So I saw the opportunity to develop special browser software for the interface side and tie it all to the internet. So that became the beginnings of what we worked on. And after I formed Leader in 97, I put together a team of developers, and I said, look, there's an opportunity here to use the browser and the internet to collaborate in a new way. And to cut a long story short, by 1999, we had the magic aha moment and realized that we had invented something very special. And what everyone knows it now to be is social networking.
So it was basically just the idea that multiple people could be using the same platform at the same time. Do I have that right in the most elementary form? Or correct me if I'm wrong about that. The idea that people could communicate in real time. That was the magic moment, I guess, for you, is to realize that you had come up with something that was able to fulfill that requirement. Is that a synopsis?
Yeah, at a real high level, yes.
Because we take it for granted so much now, the idea that we can have multiple people on any platform. I mean, we're talking about all platforms, and you were talking about how really the apps in our phones, everything, rely on this technology. It all has its basis in this. So we're not talking about social networking per se. We're talking about, it's not even the engine. It's like the entire platform upon which that's built.
That's right. Yes, we didn't assume there weren't other people working on something similar at the time, so we were just trying to commercialize what we had invented. But as that next decade developed in the 2000s, we began to realize that we were unique, and that what happened after that is a horrible story of property theft by the federal government. So who then turned around and gave it to all these technology companies. So that's why you see our technology is so ubiquitous now on phones and on the internet, is because they basically distributed our code to everyone.
That's the leap forward, I suppose, in terms of what you understand now to be the situation. But you were just a person that was developing a patent and doing your music. And I'm sort of setting the scene there, because on Character Driven, I do have a lot of people who tend to be minding their own business, for lack of a better word, and doing the right thing in their life. And I think for the average person, they have a hard time understanding that your life can really change, sometimes at a moment's notice, but maybe over time, you begin to have this revelation that the world is not as you thought it was. And I think particularly for Christians, this is a very difficult thing. I know that talking to people in a church setting, for instance, they're often very in favor of the government, and they want to be supportive, and you know, they want to set a good example of good citizenship and that sort of thing. And they have a very difficult time, even more so, I think, than some of the folks that are exposed a little bit more to the realities of the world. So I think that might categorize how you were. You know, there you were with your family and raising your kids and homeschooling and doing all these wonderful things in your work life. You were having the veil lifted, I guess. So tell me about that point where all of that started to become noticeable, or where you became aware of it. Was it sudden, or was it a slow understanding? First of all, tell me about the patent, because I want people to have a firm understanding of the fact that you did apply for and receive a patent.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So after we had the aha moment in 1999, the internet probably had less than 10 million users. So it wasn't commercial. We couldn't make any money off of it yet. So what we decided to do was protect our intellectual property by filing patents. And so that's what we started working on almost immediately after having the magic moment, when we realized we had something quite unique. But that was during my business phase. And if I go back to answer your question about the ministry phase, I wasn't naive to the world. We had worked in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, and we had seen a lot of abuse by governments over their people. So that wasn't something that was a surprise to me. But what I was surprised by is that America was heading toward a similar moral crisis. And that I wasn't expecting, because everyone looked up to the West during the communist days, and looked at that as the place where there's the land of opportunity, and so we didn't really question too much the motives of our government, as probably we should have. Now I can see we should have, but at the time, I wasn't assuming that, and I was, your typical Christian who had prayed for his government and prayed for the president, and or if I was in Canada, I'd pray for the prime minister, and we believed that God would answer our prayers, and we'd move on, and they'd do their job, and we'd do ours,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
I was one of those kind of people that gave people the benefit of the doubt and didn't assume every time I met somebody they were trying to cheat me. So that was, yeah, I was very much like that myself. I like approaching people. I like meeting people. I like learning from people. So having a very sarcastic worldview was not in my DNA either. Mm-hmm. After we moved back from the UK, I started into business, and I basically decided, okay, I'm going to try to be successful in business and be honest. And that was one of my criteria. Now, some people thought that was naive. I can see now that was naive. that business is a different environment, has a different moral base, there's a good biblical description. There's many times there's wolves in sheep's clothing. And one of the things I've learned over the years is that these wolves are very adept at fooling Christians who they know are giving them the benefit of the doubt. And that, if I could say there's one lesson I've learned, that's one. Mm-hmm. And yet I don't want to be cynical with every relationship that I have, but I've learned you have to be careful because there are a lot of wolves out there who specifically use that opportunity, that time they get while the Christian is giving them the benefit of the doubt to basically tear their assets apart, tear their life apart, take advantage of it, steal from them, whatever. There's a lot of those kind of people out there. So when I started the software business, I was looking to build software and market it, and I didn't really know the bigger picture of the internet, and except that it looked like a promising mechanism for building a business. Hindsight shows me that was naive. Hindsight shows that the internet has never been anything but a weaponized network for the intelligence agencies in our planet, and that's a very quick description of what 10 years of dealing with the aftermath of winning and losing our Facebook lawsuit. But let me step back a minute and say we sued Facebook for we got our patents started our patents started to be issued in 2006. And we started then looking around to see who was infringing our patent, and pretty much we saw everybody. So we decided to sue Facebook. And at the time, Facebook and MySpace were the two primary platforms. And we sued them in late 2008 and started preparing for trial. The trial occurred in July of 2010. And we had a very good law firm that was pursuing the case. And we proved on 11 of 11 counts that Facebook is infringing our patent. And then the court turned around and rejected our claims anyway on a trumped up charge that we had tried to sell the technology too soon. And you can't possibly understand the esoteric nature of this rule. It's called on sale bar, and I'm not even going to try right now. But basically, it was an attorney-fabricated claim that protected Facebook. Now, they didn't fulfill any of the legal requirement to prove that, and yet the courts supported it anyway, all the way through the appeals court, all the way to John Roberts and the Supreme Court. We then, this was in 2012, we then looked at the situation and said, what is going on here? And, you know, being a person who believed that our court system was there to protect us as citizens, the first thing that stood out like a sore thumb was we started looking at the financial statements of the judges that were involved in our case, and we found that all of them had massive amounts of Facebook interests that they did not disclose. And at an ethical level, they should have recused themselves, and they didn't. And so then we said, well, whoa, that stinks. And so I had a choice. I mean, I could have walked away, and nobody probably would have faulted me for saying, okay, you tried, you didn't make it, and move on. And the engineer in me wanted to figure it out, wanted to figure out what's going on here. Why did we not get treated fairly in our court? And that began a trek in 2012 that's led to today. And I think I'll stop there and see if you have any questions.
There's so many questions that come to mind. I'm thinking in terms of that time frame between when you were creating this technology and when it actually became used by the powers that be and the people that stole it from you. Okay, so it was in the 90s. I heard 1997. I think that might have been a pivotal year for you. Was that when you actually did come up with that aha moment, or am I wrong about that? Did I hear that wrong?
No, 97 was when we started the company, and I put a development team together. And then we then spent the next 2.5 years inventing. And it was in late 99, it was actually Christmas of 1999, when we had the aha moment and figured out why the current market that was led by IBM and AT&T and Novell GroupWise and Lotus Notes, why they were not going to be able to scale their technology to the internet. When we saw that, and because most of us had done one of the major systems on the planet, in defense, in banking, even we had a group from satellite and missile imagery systems in the Air Force, and basically a very skilled group of people. So when we saw, we had the aha moment, we all knew it was special. And so that's why I made a beeline to Washington to start working on filing patents to protect our invention. So we were very secretive and very clear that we knew we had something special and we're going to protect it. So that was in 1999. That was when we had the idea. We had done some coding, but the serious coding then occurred over the next 3 years. So we developed a total of about 750,000 lines of source code, about 145,000 man hours to build it. But the innovation really occurred in late 99. But as you know, you don't magically have the innovation. Sometimes it takes years to get to the point where you've eliminated everything else and then realize what it should be.
Unless you're Mark Zuckerberg, because then you can do it over the spring break. It's amazing.
Right.
Yeah, the sarcasm is right there at the tip of my tongue. But I'm thinking about the situation at that time. For those that may not remember, that was when Bill Clinton was actually president. And apparently Al Gore was inventing the internet at that time. Again, a rather sarcastic view of things. Bill Clinton wasn't necessarily as advertised either. Right now, we're focusing a lot on the Clinton Foundation and Hillary Clinton and all the ne'er-do-wells in that situation. But I remember you saying that Bill Clinton was actually a CIA operative. Am I right about that, or am I mischaracterizing that, or can we set that up a little bit to give a sense of what was actually happening politically as well at the same time?
Okay. Well, none of those things were even on my radar screen at the time. They have come to the radar screen in the last 2 or 3 years as we peeled back the onion layers of this corruption, because somebody stole from us. The judges were in on it. That we had proven. We didn't know why. And to cut a very 5 years of investigation short here, we've recognized that this intention by our government to control the internet and to control, monitor communications and surveillance, mass surveillance, has been a plan of the government since the early 90s. It goes back to George H.W. Bush, Daddy Bush. And so there's been a long-term plan to have this mechanism for spying and government control for a long time. And so if we go through the 1990s, when Clinton was in power, a lot of those mechanisms were being set up at the time. There were some groups. The FBI was involved with it. A group called the Highlands Forum that became the Highlands Group was really the spiritual center of this plan. And then you had a lot of laws being changed and altered during that period of time. And then IBM was very central to that all through the 90s. And now what I'm going to share with you, we've only recently discovered, but it has become clear that coming into the late 90s and early 2000s, this group of people believed that IBM and Microsoft were going to provide the technology that was needed to make this collaboration work on a large scale. But they were focused on solutions that they had all had for a decade called groupware. And if you remember Lotus Notes and various types of collaborative environments that were really popular in the 90s, they were popular to the point that they were almost a religion. So you ask anybody that during that period, if it didn't involve Lotus Notes, there used to be a saying, and you never got fired for hiring IBM. And they bought Lotus Notes, and it was going to be the answer to everything in the internet. So by the late 1990s, this was part of our, we assumed that too, actually, for years. And then our magic aha moment was we realized, hey, that technology is not going to work in the internet. It cannot work and will not work. That was our aha moment. So we pushed all the papers off the drawing board and we started over. And that's when we had the innovation. And so what people experience now with, you know, you share a photo on any of these platforms and a million people can see it. That is our invention, how that happens. And so, to kind of summarize it a little bit more, it's a new type of metadata. It's not like the old type of metadata. It's a whole new type where people can exchange information without passing around whole files all the time. Because if you've ever had somebody send you a megabyte attachment to an email, you know, if that person's sending it out to 100 people, there's 100 megabytes of files floating around. But we figured out how to do that with maybe 10,000 bytes. And so that was the innovation. And so by the time this deep state shadow government was planning on moving forward with IBM and Microsoft, they realized they were getting stuck. And as fate would have it, as God would have it, I guess, that was when we came along. And when I showed it to our attorney who we had engaged in Washington, D.C., it's now clear he was working with this other group, and he knew they needed this technology, and so therefore they set out to steal it from the day one. We were screwed from the moment we ever went to Washington, is the bottom line. And yet that's only something we've recently discovered.
How did you actually meet up with that particular lawyer? Was that somebody that was referred to you, or was it somebody that you knew prior to that time? Or do you feel like he was put on to you now in hindsight?
Nobody knows what they don't know, but it was a networked introduction that I believe was not pre-planned, but it was serendipitous for them. So I was introduced to somebody who was introduced to somebody else who introduced us to him, and then we got to him. So it was four layers of introductions. So I really don't think that it was pre-planned. It was a pre-planned thing. But once they knew what we had, then it was all planned.
Funny how the word gets out when you've got a good network of people that are keeping their eyeballs on things like this. Something that people may not understand is that patent law is one of the most corrupt areas of law, I guess. And coincidentally, that was the area of law that Hillary Clinton herself chose to pursue when she first became a lawyer. I think her dad, who was not exactly the most upstanding individual, suggested that she go into that area of law. And it's quite well known to me now, of course I didn't know it then, that those are the very people that will be complicit in stealing patents. One of the things about patents is, from my understanding of patents, is that that's what you want to secure first of all. It's like Monsanto wanting to buy up every single aspect of humanity so that they can put a patent on it, including the cure for cancer or whatever. It's really quite evil when you think about how they're going to monetize everything in the world, including our DNA, is seriously something that they're looking at doing, some of these companies. So unless we understand the whole area and the nature of patent law, sometimes this is lost to people. And I wonder if the deep state is closely associated with that entire group, that crew.
Well, now I'm sure of it. This is one area where I approach the patent system as honorable. And that was probably my mistake as a Christian. And that puts us in a disadvantage because what I now know is that being a patent lawyer is a license to steal. Now, that doesn't mean all patent lawyers are thieves, but it does mean that the patent system itself is, let's put it this way, there are many motives that don't necessarily care whether the inventor is protected or not. But if you think about it from the standpoint of a professional corporate thief, what better way to get new ideas than pick off the patent ideas as they're still on the drawing board from an inventor? I mean, it's brilliant if you don't have any morals.
Well, this reminds me a little bit of the academic world, too, because, you know, it's the publish or perish concept when you are a tenured professor. And you think about all the thesis ideas that come across your desk, perhaps even that get rejected, and that suddenly appear in that academic's work down the road. And so I think it's akin to that. A lot of people have had that experience where their ideas or their work has been published under another name. And they have no way of really verifying. You know, as a writer, I used to send emails to myself quite a bit with ideas. And, you know, we do what we can to protect ourselves. But that protection can only go so far, because if the courts are complicit, then we're going to have a very difficult time being able to support our claim, you know, even if there is a patent involved. I think that's the part that, for me, is the really naive part. And I told you a little bit about having a trademark in Canada and how that can be just taken out from under you if somebody else decides that they own it, and even though you've gone through the proper vetting process. And so I've had a slight sampling of that, but I think the problem is that people go, oh, well, you know, if they have a patent, then of course they can just go to the courts and they can have that upheld. And so clearly there must be some problem with those of us that have gone through the proper channels. You know, we become the ones that seem to be...
Right. I think that I've come to conclude that we have a number of various institutional feeder systems that essentially prey on creative people as a mechanism, as a intentional mechanism to eventually exploit the ideas that are exploitable. And it's in academia, it's in the venture capital world, it's in the patent system, and they're all designed to take the young and naive and inexperienced idea creators. And for all of us who are like that, you don't have time for all this nonsense. You just want to really focus on solving a problem or fixing something or being creative. And that, you know, that's the image of God in us, to have an idea and to articulate it into being. I mean, that's the creative process. And yet these people aren't creative. All they know how to do is exploit and steal. And I think that in the big picture kind of defines evil. And so consequently, we've got a lot of institutions that we pray for a lot that need a lot more prayer, because they are indeed, they have many ways to Sunday to take something that even is issued, like a patent or a trademark, and undo it if they want to. There's many ways to Sunday, many ways to Sunday to do that.
And you are relying so heavily on the expertise of, say, a lawyer in that case. And you do actually, and it isn't always the lawyer. It can go beyond that too. But of course, there you were in Washington, D.C., which is, we now know, is the swamp. And, you know, without getting into that too much, I think we understand that Washington, D.C. is a place unto itself. In fact, it really does have its own jurisdiction. So some people may not understand that, too, that they have their own police department. They have their own, I guess it's the Capitol Police, is it? So just as an example, there's things that go on in D.C. itself that may supersede some of the other things that are going on in the country. So there is that aspect.
The separate jurisdiction of the District of Columbia, I'm aware of, and the fact that they have their own set of rules and they have a separate corporation. There's a lot of game. I think the bottom line is when you get a group of lawyers together, they can play more games than Carter has liver pills. And what we've got now is so many layers of gaming. And it's all self-serving. It's all to support a system that is basically feeding itself and taking care of itself, with the taxpayers at the other end of that, feeding that network. And I mean, that's just that is the system. So the patent game is a lawyer's game for sure, and secondarily bankers who then fund the groups that want to exploit the better ideas. Mm-hmm. And in our case, there was a third layer, and that was the intelligence world. The intelligence world, as we've now can see very clearly, wanted to control internet transactions and internet communication and to monitor it all. And they couldn't do it with the old IBM and Microsoft legacy groupware technology. And so they realized that our solution was the elegant next step, and basically set out to steal it, and they did steal it. And if you remember, the social networking world really emerged like a phoenix in 2004. Well, that's because on October 28th of 2003, we finally debugged the last module in our system, it was ready. It was ready for prime time, and magically, that was the same night that Zuckerberg hacked the house sites at Harvard. Surprise, surprise.